I don't know where I would be had it not been for my mother making a lot of sacrifices to just deal with this very traumatic situation that was happening in our family, happening with her oldest child. That coupled with the support of teachers and educational advisors kept me going. I think the biggest thing that I learned and I rely on even now is that at a very early age, the moment when I knew I was going to become a mother, I had to, with my 14-year-old mind, reckon with myself and say, okay, what are going to be my non-negotiables? Because life is about to be drastically different, but I have to have some things that I will do and will not do going forward.
Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations with the artists and makers who use their creativity to innovate, disrupt, and elevate. When Krista David was 14 years old, she was a student at the LaGuardia School for the Arts, which is otherwise known as the FAME School, and she was headed for college. Then she got pregnant. So Krista made a decision. She decided that the story that one normally tells about a young, poor Black girl who gets pregnant at 14 would not be her story. She would go on to college, she would get an education and have a career and create something different for her life. And she did. She got a bachelor's and a master's. She had a career as a public health researcher and became a supervisor, earning a six-figure salary in New York City, all while raising her daughter. But Krista didn't forget art. She never stopped making it. She made it in the cracks, in the evenings and on the weekends, until it no longer worked, until she wanted to spend more time making art than sitting in meetings. So after much deliberation, Krista quit. She quit the job, the salary, the security, the certainty, to make art full-time and be a full-time artist. This is the story of Krista's life as a full-time artist. It's the story of the ups and downs of being your own boss, of comparison and how to deal with the inevitable jealousy and envy. It's about how to market and how not to market your own thing, what it means to make art as a Black woman in America today, and how to go from doing art on the sidelines to making it your full-time gig. May you enjoy this conversation and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Hello, Krista. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Hi, Daphne. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. I begin my podcast with learning about your creativity story as a child. Mm-hmm. And by that, for you, it's more about how did painting or collage or what type of creativity showed up for you when you were a kid?
Well, the funny thing is I don't have any recollections of doing more than what generally kids do, like color and play. I didn't really start making art until middle school. And again, it was just a part of my school curricula, and my art teacher had taken sort of a liking to what I was doing, and she really encouraged me to keep making art. But when I was 3, 4, 5, 6, I was just so focused on things like math and science. Those are the things that fascinated me. So puzzles, and I was a huge science and math geek. I knew at age 5 that I wanted to be a doctor and help sick people. And that was all I remember from childhood. And it wasn't until I was about 11 and 12 when I started to paint and do things like watercolor and acrylic painting and egg tempera in school. And it was then that my art teacher said, I think you should think about applying to a specialized high school for art because you're pretty good at it. And up until that point, I hadn't even thought about it. I just knew that I was going to study math and science in high school, and I was going to go to college and be pre-med. But that conversation changed the trajectory of my life because I did end up going to an arts-focused high school and learning about a variety of media. The high school that I went to, LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and the Performing Arts, also known as the FAME School, was just an incredible place to develop as an artist, and it exposed me to a lot of different ways to express myself through my art. Interestingly enough, the one part of my current practice that I did not do in high school was collage. I did everything besides collage and photography in high school. I focused mainly on oil painting, but now my practice is primarily collage and photography.
Okay, my first question then is, so it was really, there was no one else in your family necessarily or friends that were commenting on your art. It was your art teacher primarily that encouraged you. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I didn't have any artists in my family. I didn't come from an environment where art was talked about. I grew up very poor. We were not exposed to museums and art and all those sorts of things. And it just wasn't the focus of my childhood, and it didn't become central until I was in high school at age 13. And that's when it's sort of like, oh my God, I live in New York City and there are museums. And I was in, you know, I lived in the Metropolitan Museum at that point.
So you fell in love with art. I mean, you were making art and you were also really drawn to art.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then your story takes a bit of a turn because at 14, you found that you were pregnant, and then you went on with the support of both your family and your school, which is pretty incredible, to go and have your daughter and continue on through high school and then onto two Ivy League colleges. And I know that, Krista, I know you've shared this story a lot, and I also think it's important to lay the groundwork to give people a sense of what you've persevered through to be here today. So what I really want to know about this part of the story, this part of your life, is what you learned from the experience of being a young mother who kept going and through high school, through college, raising your daughter the whole time, and how of what you learned, what you lean on today.
So I've learned quite a bit, but I think the thing that looms large is this idea of community and support. And you really can't accomplish much without having community and support. I don't know where I would be had it not been for my mother making a lot of sacrifices to just deal with this very traumatic situation that was happening in our family, happening with her oldest child. That coupled with the support of teachers and educational advisors kept me going. I think the biggest thing that I learned and I rely on even now is that at a very early age, at the moment when I knew I was going to become a mother, I had to, with my 14-year-old mind, reckon with myself and say, okay, what are going to be my non-negotiables? Because life is about to be drastically different, but I have to have some things that I will do and will not do going forward. So I made a list of non-negotiables, and top of the list was simply, I will not drop out of school. Education and educational attainment is a non-negotiable. Not only is it going to improve my circumstances, it's just going to allow for opportunity for myself and for my daughter. So going to class every day was a non-negotiable. Doing my homework was a non-negotiable, no matter how tired I was. Going to my after-school college round program was a non-negotiable. Going to my Saturday writing class is non-negotiable. Applying to schools and applying to college in general was a non-negotiable. There will be no breaks. You will keep going. And now when I'm out here working on my own and thinking about how I want to run my art business, my art practice, I still have a list of non-negotiables. What are gonna be the key things that I'm gonna do in order to set my art practice up, set up my art business? So I rely on that skill of like being very, very clear on what it is you're going to do and not going to do in order to achieve your goals and manage your life. So that was really important for me. So community, and then just being very, very clear on what my non-negotiables were going to be. Because without them, I mean, I could have been all over the place. It could have gone differently for me in a lot of ways. I'm really, really cognizant of the fact that my story is not the traditional story. And it's not what usually happens to Black women at the time, Black girls like me. It could have gone a different way at a lot of different points. Incredibly grateful that I did have the support that I had, and I did have the divine wherewithal to say to myself, no, this is just something that happened. And though it is traumatic, there's still opportunity. There's still a choice that I get to make, right? Because at the end of the day, it comes down to your choices. There's still a choice I get to make in this situation. I get to wake up every day and I get to go to school and I get to do my best and I get to dream about being in places like Colombia. And then once I get there, I get to continue to do the work and continue to take care of myself and take care of my kid.
So there are a number of things that you just said that I think are really important, some of which I'll follow up with questions and some I just want to highlight. First of all, the idea that you say this was what happened to you in terms of the life that you then continue to pursue and live today is not the traditional outcome for a lot of young women, young Black women who would get pregnant, any woman for that matter, who would get pregnant at 14 years old. But obviously different for a white person than a Black person or a woman of color. But still, what I want to underline there is we all have excuses as to why we can't do what we want to do. And your story is such a powerful example of no matter what the excuse is, it's not really a good one. There are never valid excuses because you have overcome so much to be where you are today. And so I wanted to highlight that. And then also this idea of non-negotiables. Brendon Burchard just recently wrote a book about high performance, high performers and characteristics of high performers. And the number one thing that he starts with is clarity. And you had that clarity at 14 because you said, what is non-negotiable for me? And I think that's incredible. And I also wanted to ask you around that, what are some of your non-negotiables today with your art?
Well, the thing that I think about a lot currently with my art is being very, very clear that my art practice is distinct and separate from my art business. And it's really important that I not confuse the two, because if I make decisions from the vantage of my art business about my art practice, I'm going to start doing things that may not be authentic, right? So an example of that, for business, I want to sell original art because that helps me pay my bills. It helps me buy more art supplies. It helps me sustain my life. But having that be my reality, I don't want to start producing things like, you know, projecting onto my art practice. Oh, well, this is doing really well. So let me do more of this because I can get more sales that way. So I'm very, very careful about being authentic, you know, still having a plan for my art business, but my art practice is really important. And I'm trying to develop some really deep roots around making things that are distinct and particular to my experience as a Black woman in America. And that's a varied experience for me. It's not just pointing at things that need to be pointed at, like systems of oppression and racism and gentrification and all those things that are heavy. It's also pointing at things like joy and resilience and family and community and our relationship to the divine. So I just have to be very, very clear about these two separate, distinct domains that I'm trying to navigate and not confusing them. That's a non-negotiable to me. Like, do not mix up what you're trying to do with each of these things, your art practice and your art business. Another non-negotiable for me is I don't want to get into the comparison train. I love social media with all my heart. I love Instagram. I live in my Instagram stories. There's so much creativity. There's so many incredible artists, brilliant artists out there doing some amazing things. But a non-negotiable for me is you do not want to get caught up in comparison. They have a different assignment than what you have, Krista. Your assignment is very particular and very distinct. And your job, Krista, is to get still enough so that you can get your instructions from your relationship. And for me, it's God, to get your instructions and not to pay too much attention to what other people are doing. You can celebrate them, but don't get caught up because you can't do what they do. Like, it's just an impossibility. I cannot do what I love. There's this one painter that I love. Her name is Amy Sherald. She was just selected to paint the portrait of Michelle Obama. Amy is brilliant. I cannot do what she does. Kerry James Marshall is brilliant. I cannot do what he does. Romare Bearden was a genius. I cannot do what he does. All I can do is figure out what it is I can do and do it to the best of my ability. So that's another non-negotiable. Focus on your own stuff.
Yes. I'll pause you for a minute because I have already a couple questions just around that. And we can get back into more non-negotiables because these are great. The first one is the keeping the art business separate from the art practice. And I'm curious with that, like where the line is between, I understand like, okay, I'm not going to just make this because this sells. And yet at the same time, you do need to support yourself and make a living from it. Where do you cross that line, or when do you cross that line? Like, when is it important to also just make the prints that sell, and then other times to just make what's true to you as an artist, as a Black woman in America, those different things?
So here's where I got this piece of advice from another artist I listened to on a panel. His name is Derek Adams. And he said, it's really important, one, to get clear on your audience and to get clear on the visual language of your audience. So I can still make the art that I want to make because I know that there's a group of people out there to whom my art speaks to. So it's my job, putting my business hat on, to go find those people, right? It's easy to fall prey to this idea of like, oh, just look at your analytics and look at your sales and see which thing is working and just do more of that. Yes, that's one way to do it, and there's no judgment in that. And you can definitely do that because I do think there's this supply and demand thing happening. But I do feel like there's so many people on this planet, and I don't need to talk to all of them with my work. I just need to find the ones who gravitate towards my work and sell to them and like share my art with them. So I haven't figured out a perfect system at present, but I am spending a lot of my time thinking about, I just want to make art, the art that makes me feel good, but at the same time triggers experience in the people for whom my art is for. And I think it's possible. Like, I'm not at a point where I am making a full-time living with my art, but I am always amazed, and I get the same kind of feedback from all of my collectors about their emotional response to my work. And I'm like, yes, you are my people. You're the people I'm making this art for. And I just need to find where the rest of y'all are.
Got it. That's great. And then as you're doing that, you mentioned the second one, which is not getting caught up in the comparison trap, which honestly I find to be almost impossible. So how are you not getting caught up in the comparison trap?
I agree. I mean, it's not that I don't have any feelings. Like, so I do get feelings of envy or jealousy at different points. It happens. But I'm so in tune with those feelings. And the minute I feel them, I stop and I'm like, Krista, what do you really want about this situation? Because you don't know this person. Thing that this person has been able to achieve should be celebrated. So why are you really envious or jealous? And then that's when I take a moment, I say, oh, because I want that. And so I let the jealousy and the envy, you know, help me clarify my own vision for my art practice and my art business. Because sometimes it's almost like you just got to let those feelings lead you and not eat away at you. So I take note of them. I appreciate them. And I say, you know what? That book deal that artist got, man, I wish I would have. I want one of those. Okay, well, put that note down in your journal, in your planner, because that's something that you need to work on. I don't beat myself up for feeling envious or jealous of things that I see online, but I do pay close attention to it, and I do interrogate that feeling. Like, I want to know why I'm feeling that way. And if it becomes to be too much, I have supports in place where I can go and process those feelings. I have a best friend who happens to be a therapist, and I will get on the phone and say, this is what I'm feeling, and this, you know, why hasn't this worked out, and why hasn't that worked out? And I process them. I just don't want to get too caught up in it to the point where it paralyzes me and it makes me not want to do my own work.
Well, and I think the fact that you acknowledge it in the way that you do and recognize why it's there, why it's showing up for you, it mm-hmm. won't paralyze you because you've given it the voice that it's looking to have. I mean, mm-hmm. So that's a great approach. Before I ask you some questions specific to, you know, leaving the day job and then specific to your art and the process, are there more non-negotiables that you wanted to mention?
Let's see. Another non-negotiable, and this is one that I struggle with, but it's important. Being an artist, I just have to remind myself that risk is essential. And even though it's uncomfortable sometimes to take a risk in my artwork or go into places where may not be comfortable for me, or I may not feel like I have the skill in order to really execute the vision that I have in my mind, I have to just remind myself that risk is essential. And I'm not going to have a long practice, art practice, unless I am taking those sorts of risks every day. And they don't need to necessarily be on public display, i.e. social media, but it does need to be something that shows up when I'm in the studio. I need to be taking risks because I'm just not going to gain the kind of impact that I want to gain with my work if I'm not pushing the limits of the media that I'm using, pushing my own intellectual limits and emotional limits. So risk is a non-negotiable at this point, and I'm still working out how that looks every single day when I'm in the studio.
So an example might be if you're painting or making a collage, walk me through one way in a typical day or a non-typical day, how you would take a risk with that.
So one of the things that I recently did, I recently had my first solo show.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And it was of my collage work in particular. And the very last piece I made for the show, I decided to get into this. I'm fascinated by sculpture. I'm fascinated by 3D work. All of my work is 2D, except for this one piece that I made that's part of the show. And I was a little nervous about it. I was just like, well, I want to do this collage, but I want it to come off of the page. How do I do this? And I used some fiber in the work. And I remember when I was stitching it onto the paper and everything in me was nervous and excited. And it was all these emotions because I didn't know how it was going to be taken by the viewers because up until this point, I had never done anything like that. But when I dropped the work off to the gallery and the gallery owner was looking at the work, she looked at that piece in particular and she was like, she said, is this the most recent thing you've made? And I said, yes. And I was like sweating because I was like, oh my God, what is she going to say? And she was just like, I think you need to stay here. And I was just like, oh, and I wasn't even going to bring this particular piece to the show because I just wasn't sure about how it was going to be displayed and I hadn't figured out any of those things. But that was an example of me taking something that was familiar to me. And it was in this particular case, yarn, like I'm a big knitter and crocheter and that kind of thing, but taking this other part of me and sort of putting it into the comfortable plane of paper, and paper is very comfortable for me. So that's just one example. Another example is I'm back oil painting again, which was a struggle. Like most of my painting is in acrylic, but most of my art training is in oil painting. So it was sort of like, oh, do I want to go back into this area? Do I want to do portraiture, which is not my strong suit? But again, I'm pushing myself because I think there's stories to be told with figures, same way there's stories to be told with just color and shape. So those are two examples.
Those are great examples, especially I love that first example of you putting something, creating something that you'd never created before and feeling the nerves, feeling the excitement around it, and bringing it to the gallery owner and having her say, yeah, stay here, work with this. Like that,
yeah,
that's fantastic. That is a great example of taking risk. So, okay, let's back up a little bit and talk about this transition from your full-time day job, which was your very successful woman working in public health and making six figures, moving from a full-time day job to being a full-time artist. I want to talk a little bit about that transition and then get into your art. So tell me how that transition came to be.
When I decided to quit my day job, this is something I had been thinking about for a while. Prior to quitting a year ago, I had spent about 6 years making art in the cracks, so nights and weekends after work, that kind of thing. And I think at the third year mark, I started to get uncomfortable and I started to want to make art during the day and not just at night and on the weekends. And then it just got increasingly painful. I think this is classic to when it's time to move to another place, is you start to get uncomfortable. It starts to physically feel painful to go do something. So for me, even though I loved my public health job and I had great colleagues and we were doing really great work. I mean, public health is inherently focused on issues of social justice. Like, this is good work for the soul and for society, right? But it just got to a point where I just wanted to flip the ratio in my time and how I spent my time. And I wanted to spend more time in my studio than I did in meetings. At the same time, my career, as I started to move up, it just became more and more administrative, and it was less on the ground public health research, which is what I was trained to do. So I was supervising, you know, directors and people and going to meetings for 8 hours a day and that kind of thing. And it just became less enjoyable, and I was too far removed from the people for whom I was working, right? As a public servant, I was working in New York City. I cared about the 8.4 million New Yorkers and their health in the places that they play, work, and pray. I cared about the communities in particular where over 1 million people are living below the poverty line, for example, and like what are the spaces and places in which they work, live, and play. But it just got to a point where I was too far removed from that, and I became like a bureaucrat, and I was just like, I have to make a change. And after thinking about it for a while and getting extremely burnt out, I mean, I have never experienced burnout like I did the last several months of my job as a public health researcher. I remember going into my boss's office and saying to her, I don't think I could take anymore. I need a vacation and it needs to be a month long. I originally thought she was going to say no, because that was unheard of in the organization in which I worked. But she looked at me and she was just like, let me talk to the administrator and see if this is possible. And she did. And then they got back to me, you know, the next day and said, yes, you can take a month off. And I went and I spent half of that time in Santorini just staring out at the agency. And it was there where things became very, very clear that I just wanted to do something else on my life minutes. That it was totally okay to let go of a decade-long career in public health to do something else. I'm still in the sort of fight for social justice and equity, but I'm just using different tools to do that. So I got back and I thought, oh no, I can hang in here for a little while longer. But then one day, I think it was 3 weeks after I gotten back from vacation, it was a Tuesday, I just found myself tired of complaining about the same things. And I came back from lunch and I just told my administrator, I said, you know, I quit and I don't want it to be disruptive. I'll take 5 weeks to transition my teams, and you know, it's just time for me to move on.
I really like how you said, I want to do something else with my life minutes. Like, that's such a great phrasing for that. Okay. So there's a couple things here. One is, in an interview, you said, if you're thinking about leaping from your day job into something else, you will never have a surefire plan. There is no book, no blog, no conversation that will prepare you for the ups and downs of working for yourself or doing your craft. So you made this decision. You had these moments of clarity, or just really you had clarity around this is, I can't stay at this job, even though it's something I've been doing for the last 10 years. I need to move into being a full-time artist. That was clear. Mm-hmm. And still, there are the ups and downs of that transition and then of working for yourself as a full-time artist. Can you talk about some of those ups and downs?
Oh, yes. So, of course, and I don't encourage people to, like, leave their day jobs. It is not romantic. In fact, it is very, very, very hard. This is the hardest thing that I've ever had to do. And I became a mother at 14. So being my own boss has been harder than becoming a mother at 14. Seriously. So the things really started to hit the fan after the day after my job was over. You know, everything is great. You're transitioning out. Everybody's celebrating you and supporting you. But in those first few months, things were very, very lonely. Now, I'm a motivated person. I don't need anybody to tell me when to do my work, how to do my work. I'm all about goals setting and planning and executing my goals. But it was the emotional sort of instability. It was me having to reckon with the fact that the first time in since I was 13 that I would not be getting a paycheck every 2 weeks. Like, I've been working since I was 13 for a physical paycheck. And now here I am 37 and that won't be happening in the next 2 weeks. It was like a shock to my system. Like, everything I had known up until that point, I had always had a job or two or three. And now it was no check is coming in. You don't have people to talk to on a daily basis. So I just had to come up with ways to support the loneliness of being an entrepreneur and just a full-time artist. I had to reckon with the financial piece of it. Thankfully, I did have quite a bit of savings where I was able to sort of sustain myself. I'm still able to sustain myself. But those first 3 months were very scary. Everything I thought that was going to work out did not work out. Like, I thought I was going to do this transition into doing a little bit of public health consulting to hold me over or to make extra money. All of those opportunities just fell by the wayside within the first 3 months. I was just full of nerves every day. I was just so, so, so afraid. And it wasn't until about November, December, because I quit my job in September last year, where I started meditating. I downloaded this app and I started doing these breathing meditations every day, and it just started to help stabilize my anxiety. But those first 3 months were really, really challenging, but things started to even out at the beginning of this year, and I just started to just be very, very steady and deliberate in all of my actions and intentions. And things slowly started to fall into place.
So would you attribute things falling into place to that deliberateness?
I think it, I don't know how people feel about this, but I decided to have a word be sort of like the guiding force of my year for 2017. And that word was steady. I didn't want to be a word that was too over the top or what have you. I just want it to be steady because I didn't want to do the whole roller coaster ride that happened those first 3 months out of quitting my job. So for this entire year, there were some really high points and there were some low points, but in all of it, I was intentional about keeping my mind steady and not getting too overly emotional about anything, whether it was really, really great or whether it was really, really bad. And just really focusing in on my gratitude practice And the more I did that, and the more I just came from this place of being grateful and being steady and being open about what I was working on, the more opportunities came my way. And wow. With those opportunities, you know, came financial gains and support. So, yeah, it's just not easy trying to do this on your own. So you have to have some systems in place to help you. And I think self-care practices are really important. Support systems for friends and family are really important. And just know that things will work out. I also, and this is the last thing and I'll stop talking, but one of the things that helped me quit my job, honestly, well, there was a lot of things, but I imagined what the worst case scenario would be. And it wasn't so bad. And I just said, the worst thing that can happen is I run out of all of the money I have. I can't pay my rent, so I get evicted. And then I have to go sleep on my best friend's couch or on my mother's couch. It's fine. I can always go back and get a job. I'm very skilled. I have a wide network. If I have to do it all over, I can. But I had thought about the cost of what it would look like for me, you know, making this leap. And again, I don't have any small children at home. So that wasn't a part of my analysis. I think people have to make the best choices for where they are in their lives. And for me, it just didn't seem like a bad thing to make this leap. And if I lost everything just to start over, it didn't scare me. That part didn't scare me.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing I want to speak to for a second here is this idea that it's not this romantic, wonderful utopia making art all the time, because we tend to think that way. And being an entrepreneur, working for yourself, I agree with you. My meditation teacher once said to me, the most intense spiritual practice you'll ever have is raising your kids. And I agreed with that until I started my own business, which I found to be a lot more intense, actually, in a lot of ways. So I think it's so important that we recognize that, because it gets we paint such pretty pictures of what it looks like to be an entrepreneur, and there's all the, oh, travel wherever and da 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 da, and all these stories on the internet. And it's so much more than that. So
yeah, and for artists in particular, I was just sharing this morning on Instagram stories. For artists in particular, like, I haven't been in my studio for 3 weeks. And that's because I just finished this show where I made all this work. I had to do all the follow-up with all the collectors who purchased the work. Now I have to set up prints for the pieces because people are asking them. So it's like now I'm in my business. I'm not in the studio. So a good week is 15 to 20 hours of art making. That's full time. That's because you got to do all the other stuff. You spend most of your time trying to market and show your work and apply for things. If people are thinking that, oh, I'm going to quit my job and make art full time, that is not 40 hours of making art full time. You're getting 15 to 20 hours a week of making art. And the rest is making a business out of your art.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're going to get into that piece, the whole marketing and the business. But first, I want to get into your art. So when I was listening to other interviews and also just looking at your work, I was noticing both the painting and the collage. And I realize now you're saying you're doing mostly collage, although also painting. So I want to speak to, we'll start with the collage. But what was interesting, you had a quote from an interview where you said, "My paintings illustrate what I feel and my collages illustrate what I think." And then you went on to say this about your collages. "In my collage practice, I tend to work with themes of social justice, self-identity, and politics. I'm always curious, how did we get here? How did we get ourselves into this situation? What is the root cause of this particular inequity? When did it start? Who are the players? Who is the victim? I'm constantly thinking about how to get to a place of solutions. I'm not trying to offer any solution. I think that you need to unearth the story and unearth the origin. I like collage for that reason, because I can pull from present day and historical materials and fuse them together to say, hey, we should probably think about this." So on a personal level first, how has the work that you've done with collages helped you sort through your own questions around social justice, self-identity, inequity, and help you come to, if you have, arrived at some answers?
I don't know if I've arrived at any answers. I do try to illustrate my frustration or response to certain things that are happening. And I'm trying to balance that also with my hope for what I would like to happen. So there's one piece that I'm pulling up in my mind right now. The piece is called The Road Back Home. And this is more of a this is more of a private piece. And it's of a woman. She's walking into a forest and these tall trees. And this is just me thinking about a lot of the issues that we have or that we see happening in present day. I think it's part of a reflection of just our disconnection from ourselves and our disconnection and disassociation with humanity. Because think about it, if we really valued every individual person, I mean, really value them and just valued humanity, we probably would not be seeing some of the things that we're seeing play out just on basic television news, right? It's just the constant disrespect and the disregard for certain types of people. So when I make pieces like that, I'm pointing at this thing, and maybe it's a solution and maybe it's not. Maybe it's the beginnings of a solution. But this idea of, like, we have to reckon with ourselves first and our own value before we can start to think about how important it is to value others. Right? So when people disrespect other people, to me, that's more of a reflection of them and their disconnect with their own humanity. Because, like, what type of person are you to ostracize or spew hate towards another person or another group of people? That tells me a lot about the things within you that are just completely off. You need to have the time and space to sort of deal with those things, and you need to reckon with yourself, and you need to go back to your own individual home, i.e. yourself, and, like, start to deal with that so that we can get to a place of shared humanity and shared respect. Stuff like that that I think about when I'm moving around the images on the page. Again, I don't know if it's a solution, but I'm trying to start with myself first before I tell anybody else what to do. But those are the sorts of things that I think about when I'm moving these images around on the page.
And how then do you want your work with these themes of social justice and self-identity politics? I get that this is very, it's personal and you're working through it, but how do you want those themes to then make their way into the world through your art? Like, what is it that you are looking for in that person when you think of, this is the person, this is my audience, and they share with you, this is the response I had to your art? What kind of response are you hoping to elicit?
So this is the thing. I don't care what the response is. As an artist, I don't want to dictate the response to the viewer. I make the art from my vantage. My only hope, though, is that it does elicit a response. That response can be total elation and, like, it can be totally eye-opening, or it can be like you are completely pissed off and offended. I don't care which response it is, honestly, because I think the power of art is that if it's good, it can wake someone up. So I just care that you have a response. I don't need it to be in support or aligned with what I believe or my values. But if it can get you to stop and to think and to, like, trigger some sort of experience, whether that be good or bad or some sort of response, I've done my job. That's the job I think of an artist. Like, if I can get you to stop and pause for a second and to feel something, anything for a second, I've done my job.
And that's where the non-negotiable about taking risks really comes in, because in order to wake someone up in any way, like you say, whether it's a positive, negative, whatever kind of reaction they have, you have to have an opinion or be sharing something that is who you are, or mm-hmm. else you won't wake that up in somebody else. And that does require risk. So that's just to make that connection of, yeah, we elicit responses in others when we truly share who we are.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so this question, I'm curious about, as a white woman who I feel like my husband does a lot of work with racial justice, and he's woken me up to a lot of things that I've actually been totally unaware of, and surprisingly so. But it's like, oh, okay, there's so many things I don't know. And I'm curious for you as a woman artist, but as a Black woman artist, like, is that something that feels like that's a label that boxes you in? Is it something that you claim and say, this is important? Or would you rather you just be an artist and not have that put on you?
I'm glad you asked that question. That's a great question. I was talking to a bunch of artist friends about this several weeks ago. And here's where I am at this moment. And I'm leaving space for 20 years down the line, 30 years down the line, when I'm in a different place in my life. At this moment, I am very, very intentional and beholden to me being a Black woman artist in America at this time. That is a specific distinction. That is a distinction that I care deeply about. That is a distinction that I think is very important. And I welcome people use that to describe me. I care about my particulars. I'm a Black woman artist, and that is important to me, and that is my vantage, and that is where I make my work from. And I want people to know that. I get so emotional when I think about it, because I know there's a lot of tension around. I don't feel like I'm being boxed in. I feel like there's so much in that statement in and of itself. I feel like it's an expansive place for me. I feel like Black woman artist is a safe space for me. It's a place where I can celebrate myself and other women who look like me. It's a place from where I can have my very strong opinions about the things that concern me and other marginalized people. So no, I wear it with a lot of pride.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a way of defining yourself that gives you power. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Yeah, I don't feel like I'm any less of an artist just because I'm a Black woman artist. I'm still an artist, but that distinction is just, I feel like it's a privilege to be able to make art that reflects my experience, and my experience is just one of the many experiences of Black women, because that's not a monolith in any sense of the word. But yeah, it's just important to me, and I don't want to lose that. And that's from where I make my work. And who knows? I don't know where my understanding about my art is going to be when I'm 70. But right now, at 37, I'm definitely proud of being a Black woman artist.
Yeah. So as a Black woman artist, like, what does that mean in terms of what do you want to say to the world then, as like what it means to be a Black woman artist?
Well, a couple things. One, Black women are not a monolith. We have a variety of experiences, and I want to be able to celebrate and interrogate and explore and examine the many types of experiences that I've had as a Black woman walking on this earth for 37 years. And I want to be able to not only tell the stories of, or point at the things that are clearly examples of oppression and being marginalized and being seen as other, but I also want to visually tell the stories of just joy and resilience and love. Like, not all my work is about these heavy things, right? Like, I'm constantly trying to establish this balance between pointing at the things that are just really messed up about where we currently are, because I think that's important, but at the same time, pointing at things that are hopeful and that give us strength to keep going. So I don't want to not have both of those things happening in my work. And hopefully people see that. Hopefully, you know, this last show I had, it was titled Hidden Like Gold. And it was a show that was mainly focused on women of color and like putting us in these spaces, these planes of paper and color and scene that both celebrate us, spaces that we make, spaces that have been made for us. But still, it was a show that was mainly about celebrating women of color and our contributions.
Yeah.
So I can do that, but then I can also say, hey, we've done a terrible job at some of these other things that are going on in our present day society, i.e. the criminal justice system is pretty effed up, you know?
Yeah.
So or it there's a lot of opportunity for improvement, let's just say. Because I want to be positive. Like, there is, you know, there are a lot of things broken with that system. There are a lot of things that need to be fixed. There are a lot of things that need to be fixed with the educational system. You know, those sorts of things.
Yeah, and we have to be able to hold both.
We have to.
Yeah.
And we can. Like, I feel like the people that I'm making my art for, they are capable of handling both.
Yeah.
And I don't want to ever insult them by saying, hey, I can only give you pictures of flowers because that's all you can handle. No, if you want to be a collector of my work, then you have to be able to handle both. And I really sincerely believe that people can both hold the possibility and beauty, but then also they can hold the responsibility in some of this other ugliness that we're seeing, and they can sort of reckon with that as well.
Yeah, that's so valuable, because a lot of times when we want to put out work that might be controversial or might be talking about things that people don't want to talk about, we think, I wonder if I should say this. I wonder if this will be received. But instead, what you're doing, Krista, is turning it around and saying, I have that confidence in my audience. I have that confidence in my collectors. I have that confidence in my people that they can do that. And so I'm giving it to them knowing that they have the strength to hold both.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing. Okay. I have questions around the painting, but I have other questions I want to ask. So instead, is there anything that you want to say about your work in painting before we move on to some other pieces?
Not specifically. I do still feel like I paint what I feel, and my painting is full of emotion, and a lot of it, it's how I reconcile my feelings. It's how, when I can't find words or I can't find other images from newspapers or magazines or books, I turn to color and shape, and it has its function and it has its purpose. And I'm incredibly grateful to be able to go between both painting and collage and even photography to sort of tell the stories that I want to tell.
And how do you transition between that space of the thinking space, and I don't know where photography falls in that, between the thinking space of the collages and the feeling space of painting? Is there something that you do to put yourself into a particular space?
Not really. I think after I've gotten sort of fed up with what I'm thinking about or researching in order to make collages, I tend to just turn on some music. And I usually, when I'm painting, and even when I'm making collage, I'll usually have a certain song that's tied to a whole bunch of work. And I put it on as a loop in the background, and I just hack out my feelings. Like, I don't really have a plan when I'm sitting down to paint. I just let each brushstroke or color or added material respond to the last thing. Painting comes in waves. I think my collage practice is one that I have a lot more control over that, because it does require a bit of research, a bit of writing, and then a bit of sort of foraging for images to communicate what I've just read and wrote. I mean, as much as I am an analytical person, I'm still very intuitive. So I just go, I let my art take me where it needs to go. And if it's a painting season, then it's a painting season. If it's not, then I'm usually reading, researching, writing, and making collages.
Yeah. And I know, like, as you said, that you're doing art when it's a good week. It's 15 to 20 hours a week of making art, and that even the last 3 weeks have been very little of that, as you've been dealing with the gallery opening and getting the art to your collectors and now making prints. So I wanted to move into that piece briefly around marketing and business, because one of the things that you said, and you referenced this earlier actually, is nobody's emailing me, knocking on my door. I have to go out there and knock on people's doors, email them and say, hey, go look at my stuff. And what I've learned in making art is that marketing is everything, and you can spend your life doing that stuff. So tell me a little bit about ways that you market your art and what has proven most effective, what things you realize were a waste of time, and the where you focus now.
So everything is like trial and error. Thankfully, the internet is a wonderful, fabulous place where there's so much information about marketing and business that you can find free, or you can buy a book, you can take a course, and I've done all of the above. I try not to overload myself with too much information. I'm on, I think now a year out, I am squarely on the train of need to know training. And what that means is I don't read things or consume information that I don't need right now, today, this week. So if it's something that I'm like, oh, I would love to learn about, I don't know, I'm trying to think of some business, oh, retargeting Facebook ads. I think that's fascinating, but am I doing that today? Am I doing that right now? Well, then I don't need to spend any time learning about that. So that's one of the biggest things that I've learned in the last year, that you can get so caught up with consuming information that you're just not going to need. And because you, if you're like me and basically running your business team of one, you need to just focus on consuming the information and learning the things that you need to implement like right now. So that was a really important lesson. As far as the marketing, I learned also very early on, and I was on Facebook to start, and I really like Facebook. I think a lot of people like Facebook because it's easy, feels like a safe-ish space, you can do the videos, etc. But when Instagram got video and IG stories, I was just like, this is all over, because I prefer Instagram. Just like the platform. I've been on it since the beginning. I'm a visual person, and for the work that I do, it just made sense. So I primarily spend all of my time on Instagram and very little time on Facebook. That has worked for me. Things like direct messaging people, it's not in replacement of email, but it does feel less daunting to DM somebody than to send an email, a formal email. So I use a combination of both when I'm just looking for places where I can share my work or people that I want to collaborate with or connect with. And then honestly, people not only want to see your art or your thing, but they want to get to know you. And my e-tribe, like, I feel like they know me because they show up and they have coffee with me every single morning in my Instagram stories. And at the end of the day, marketing is storytelling, and people are buying people. They're not really buying the thing. Like, they want a piece of you. So if I'm sharing my process of making a piece, you know, I have people who have been following me for months and months and months, and then finally they buy something right at that moment when the thing is done. And I'm like, oh, you were waiting all this time to get understanding of, like, how was this piece made, and, like, just about me and what and how I think. So that storytelling marketing piece is so important. And, yeah, and it just takes time to build a relationship with people. So you got to figure out what's the best platform to do that. And for me, Instagram has been huge. And then I still use email, right? So I see somebody that I want to work with or somebody I want to reach out to, and I will send them an email and say, hey, I have this story that I want to tell. Can I share it with your audience? Here are the benefits that I think that they can get from it. Or if it's a gallery owner, hey, here's my work. I would love to be able to show you some work in person. You know, so you still have to go out and find your own opportunities. Nobody is going to give you anything. if you want to work on a project, so one of the things I'm doing now, one of the things I recognize now is that in looking at some of the people whom I admire and the types of things they've been able to do, a lot of it was self-funded and sort of personal project that they funded on their own and they put out into the world. And it wasn't some brand paying them and it wasn't some publisher saying, hey, do this. You have to create your own work that you want to put in the world. So when I decided, oh, I want to go to Cuba, start this Polaroid project, put together a book, I just, with the help of my friends, it was like, create the Kickstarter, make the project happen, get the book done, get the book out to people, right? So you have to figure out what it is that you want to do and figure out a way to make that thing happen even before someone is paying you to do it, right? So that, yeah. I think that's really important when you're starting out. You just have to make your personal projects.
And you mentioned the Insta stories, which are great, and that you do them every single day, and how marketing is all about storytelling. What have you learned makes for really effective storytelling?
So you definitely have to be yourself. And I suspect, and I'm still learning this now, you do have to find something that is your thing that people start to identify you with. And mine happened completely by accident, and I'm still trying to figure out how to continue to sort of let this build as a community. But I say this thing every morning when I'm making my coffee, let it bloom. And like, people just love that. They think I made it up. They think it's this thing that I'm doing. And I'm like, no, I'm just telling you exactly what's happening to the coffee. It's blooming as I pour the water. But people associate me with that, right? So I have this other hashtag that I use, not as often as I should, but it does have a lot to do with what I'm trying to do with my work. And it's called Fine Art for Everyone, right? So this idea that art is not just for people who have disposable income or who look a certain way or who go to certain places. Art really is for everyone. And no matter where you are on the social economic level, whatever social economic level you're on, you can still have art be a part of your life. You can still be an art collector and you can still support the arts.
Absolutely.
So I do think for marketing, you do want to be authentic, but then you do want to find something. What are you aiming yourself and your product, your service, my art at? And really share that as widely as possible and as consistently as possible. So people start to associate you with that thing. I mean, it's basically your brand statement and your brand identity and your brand mission and vision. And like getting, and like, I still have a lot of work to do in that area, but I suspect that that is going to be really important as I move forward to get clear on those things so that my tribe is clear on those things.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to wrap it up here. And I have two things at the end of a question and appreciation. And before that, I want to let people know that to find you, to find your art, the best place to go is christadavid.com. And that's C-H-R-I-S-T-A, David, D-A-V-I-D.com. And you'll see a lot of art. And you can, of course, go to Instagram and watch that's Krista David art, right?
KristaDavid.art. Yes.
Dot art. Yeah. So that's where you can follow her. And is there anything that I haven't mentioned that you want to speak to before I go into the last two parts?
I think we covered everything.
Okay. Okay. So this first thing is a gratitude. The thing that I want to appreciate about you that I've actually just appreciated this entire time that you have been talking is I love talking with people who are thinkers, like who contemplate, who are aware, have this awareness about themselves and life and are questioning and paying attention to the questions and listening to the answers and that deep exploration. And it is so clearly a part of who you are, just this willingness to show up, to explore, and then to share what you're finding in such an honest way. but just to go deep into life. That's what you do. You go deep. You're not afraid to go deep. And I love that. And that's also what shows up in your work. But I've really enjoyed that, both in your work and then just in this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you're very welcome. And then the last thing is why it's important that those of us who feel called to make our thing, why it's important to do that.
It's not just important. It is so, so vital. There's nothing that, and I believe this, everybody has something that they are uniquely predestined to do and to contribute in this world. And the thought of like just that not happening is kind of heartbreaking, right? Because if you believe, and this is what I believe that we're all connected. I believe that my purpose is tied into your purpose and my destiny is tied into your destiny. And imagine if you just decide not to show up for work and what kind of bind that leaves us all in. When we look around at the world and like all the things that are sort of just needed and all these opportunities for improvement, you have to ask yourself, am I not showing up for work? Because look at the state of things. Am I not doing my part? Because if we were all doing our part, if we were all doing our thing, if we was all sort of living in the flow of our divine way of being and our divine contribution, can you imagine what we would be? So I don't want to be that person, and I don't want you to be that person who's not showing up for work. And work as in you doing your own self-work, you doing the work to help somebody else. But just don't be that person. Just show up and do your part. And I'm just so hopeful that we will all be in a better space, in a much better place where everybody has enough and everybody feels as though what they're contributing is enough.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Krista.
Thank you, Daphne. Thanks so much. This is great.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. Head on over to thecreativityhabit.com to read this week's profile, The Rituals, Routines, and Day in the Life of Singer and Songwriter Jackson Emmer. You can follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram. And if you haven't yet, go to iTunes Podcast and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And then join me next week for another Creativity Habit podcast. Thank you for listening.